The Will Cain Show podcast is presented by the Capital One Saver Card. Earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment, 2% at grocery stores, and 1% on all other purchases.
Hey, what's up, folks? This week on our Will Cain Show podcast, I got to sit down with the head coach of the Texas Longhorns, Tom Herman. Now, full disclosure, as you know, I'm a fan. I'm biased, and I own that. But I talked to Tom Herman, and I think the conversation was, A, challenging. I asked him about player development, why there aren't more Longhorns in the NFL draft, and why they haven't yet lived up to all the expectations that people have for that big-time program. B, introspective. Tom and I both, I think, in a surprising way to both of us, shared parts of our lives we don't talk about much. And C, Tom's background, how he got to be one of the coaches of the biggest programs in the nation, from a graduate assistant to small schools, the life of a coach, and how many times you think about breaking through and giving up. I really liked this conversation. I think it's insightful. I think it's interesting. I think it's challenging. I hope you enjoy. Here's my conversation with Texas Longhorns head football coach Tom Herman. You're making the rounds 24/7 inside Texas Orange Bloods. You're really reaching out to connect with the fans. Why?
Well, I miss them, you know, I know that they're hurting for football at this point, and you know, I want them to see kind of a behind the curtain look at what we're doing and, you know, who we are as a family, the Herman family. And, it just made sense to me in a time like this to you know, interact with them as much as I can.
I'm glad you are. I speak, obviously, as somebody in the media, but as you know, a fan as well. And I think that a lot of people really want to get to know you. So that's some of the stuff I want to talk about today. Of course, I want to talk about the team and some of the players, your philosophy, but I want to get to know you as well. Before I do, what's your current feeling? Are you feeling optimistic, pessimistic? How do you feel about the upcoming season? Not so much, you know, how you feel about your team, but whether or not there's going to be a season.
Well, I feel optimistic, for sure. I think economically the thought of not having some sort of season is, pretty catastrophic for most athletic departments. So I think, now obviously we've got to abide by whatever the government and authorities tell us that we're permitted to do, but I do feel optimistic that one way or another, I don't know if it'll be, you know, a late start, a truncated season, only a conference season, you know, maybe push it all the way into the winter, you know, but I do think that there will be, I'm optimistic that there will be football played.
I think we're all hopeful. I hope you're right. So I want to take you up on this idea of, you know, reaching the fans. I'll be the proxy for that right now and getting to know you and the Herman family. So, I think I've kept up with you before. You were head coach of the Horns. I think I'm not out of place by saying it's weird that you and I have had close to overlaps throughout our careers. We both moved around a lot. We both have Southern California and Texas in our backgrounds. And I think it's almost odd, even down to Simi Valley, Tom, where you grew up and went to high school. I went to college in Southern California, and I feel like all my buddies are from Simi Valley, although they went to Royal, and you went to Simi High.
Yeah, I would encourage you not to talk to them anymore, because that is definitely a big rivalry, although they've had our number for many, many years. But I do know that the coach at Simi is getting things back headed in the right direction, Simi High. No, you're right. You know, with you, I believe you did your undergrad at Pepperdine, and then law school here at UT. And I myself got my graduate degree, here and did my undergrad in Southern California as well. And so, you know, growing up in Southern California, although I don't ever have any plans on moving back, I'm not into paying $1 million for a 2,000 square foot home. I will tell you that, but, you know, I did as a youngster, quite literally, surf and ski in the same day on a school day. We actually got up, really early, like at 5, drove to Zuma Beach, right there by Pepperdine, and, got a good surf in, drove back, went to class, and then, drove up to, I don't know if it was, Mammoth or Big Bear, one of the two, and got on the slopes for a little bit that evening. So, it is a fun place to live for a while, but, I absolutely positively love raising my family, not just in the state of Texas, but Austin in specific.
Just another couple commonalities we have. I picked up surfing when I was in Southern California. Now that I live on the East Coast, I have a board and I take my boys out to Long Island and we surf. But I like that you describe yourself as a Texas guy, because I will always be that. And if I could do this job of mine in Austin, I would do it in a heartbeat. So
yeah, and Long Island surfing's not, I mean, come on, Will. I mean, that's not, I mean, if you want to call that surfing, that's fine. I mean, you can, and you got your board, and I can appreciate that, but you know, there's other than, you know, Hawaii and probably Australia, Southern California is about as good as it gets.
I'll give you that. I'll give you that. I will take it anywhere the water moves and is salty. That's how much I love it. Anywhere those two things come together, I'm in.
No doubt.
All right. I want to ask you about this. So I've always been fascinated by the life of a coach. So I've got your timeline down here. If I go from Texas Lutheran, and as you mentioned, a GA at Texas. And then it's 3-year stops, man. It's Sam Houston, it's Texas State, it's Rice, it's Iowa State. And then, of course, I would assume it's the big break, Ohio State. But I'm curious. I looked at your timeline. You're 33, maybe 34 years old. You're at Texas State. You're the offensive coordinator. You've moved at this point several times. I've always been curious about the life of a coach. Is there any moment, Tom, in there where you're moving every 2 to 3 years and you're asking yourself, is this ever going to pay off? When I say pay off, I mean not as a fulfilling day-to-day job, but for it to make sense financially, geographically, familially. Do you ever get to a point where you're like, I may need to go get a steady job?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple answers to that question. One, and by the way, I'm watching surfing on FS2. I know I'm probably shouldn't be saying that on ESPN, but I've also got a couple other TVs going on, watching ESPNU and ESPN and Longhorn Network at the same time. But
good.
No, I set out, you know, I didn't grow up wanting to be a coach. I grew up, wanting to be a broadcaster. And, you know, I had a job, at NFL on Fox. I was a highlight coordinator, there for, a season or two. I can't remember, with JB and Howie, and, you know, worked at, you know, the local AM, sports talk radio station down there in Los Angeles. When I was in college, I did the PA announcing for men's and women's basketball, volleyball, and baseball at Cal Lutheran. One of the perks of going to a Division III school is you get to do things like that. And kind of had an epiphany going into my final semester of college, and you know, and the broadcasting stuff was, I liked it, but, you know, I live by the words of, I know it sounds hokey, but Confucius says, you know, find a profession you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And I loved football. I grew up, the only child of a single mom, and, you know, coaches were my dads and my teammates were my brothers, and I knew that broadcasting would keep me close to the game, but not the intimate locker room, fellowship environment that I so, that was so important to me. And so, I said, I'm going to try this coaching thing. I was a captain. My coaches said, you know, you'd make a pretty good coach someday, and I kind of laughed it off, and But I knew I had to start young. You know, I knew I couldn't go get a job selling widgets and then at 30 be sitting in a cubicle, you know, with a wife and kids making a little bit of scratch and then say, hey, I want to quit everything and go be a graduate assistant. So I knew I wanted to start young, and, you know, I'm a Division III guy that whose family was not in the profession. So had some of the cards stacked against me a little bit, and made a goal to myself that, you know, if I wasn't a FCS coordinator or a FBS position coach by the time I was 30, that I would move Michelle back to California and become a regular Joe, if you will, and figure something out. And I owed it to her to not chase this dream forever. And luckily got the tipping point was when I was at Sam Houston in 2004. I was 29 years old. Our first daughter was 11 months old, and we go 11-3, lose in the semifinals of the 1AA playoffs, and our head coach retired, and the administration went outside of the staff to fill the spot. And now being a head coach, I totally understand, but the new guy, he brought in all of his coaches, and so we were 11-3 and had as good a season in the history of Sam Houston, and I was out of a job. And, you know, pretty scary time. My wife had her MBA, and she was working at the local bank and waiting tables at night at the college bar, and at 30 years old. And so I was about a week away from taking a high school coordinator job in Houston, and we said, we'll do this for a year, and if I can't get back into college, then it's over. You know, we'll give the dream up. And, right, you know, literally a week before I was supposed to start that job, David Bayless, who was at Texas State at the time, needed an offensive coordinator and quarterback coach. I had never called a play a day in my life. I'd never coached quarterbacks a day in my life. And he took a chance on me. And I owe my career to him. We went 11-3 that year as well at Texas State, and set all kinds of offensive records. And kind of the rest is history.
It's interesting you use the word tipping point, because I was going to ask you, what do you feel like the biggest break in this journey was? But I was also going to ask you, what do you feel like the biggest breaking point was, where you thought it might be time to give it up? It sounds like it's one and the same, because I look at it and I'm thinking, well, you made the leap to Iowa State in 09. That's the Power Five. Obviously, anytime somebody goes to Ohio State, that's a big leap. Anytime you get an OC job from a position coach job, I'm thinking all of these are big leaps, but it almost sounds like to me that moment between Sam Houston State and Texas State was both maybe the lowest point and the break you needed?
Within a matter of weeks, yeah, literally. You know, I was making $29,000 a year, and like I said, you know, an 11-month-old, my wife's working two jobs, and you know, it was scary. And and then I got a great break from Coach Bayless, who I had never met before, and you know, I guess I did well on the interview and had some good recommendations. But the other obvious big point was getting the opportunity at Ohio State. I had never met Urban Meyer a day in my life. I'd never even shaken his hand. And, you know, he was out of coaching for a year, and he was he had always been a huddle guy and kind of saw in his year off, you know, the value in no huddle and up tempo and wanted a guy that was versed in that. And you know, we were like 50th in the country at Iowa State. It's not like we were setting all kinds of records, but I think he saw, you know, winning at Iowa State's really, really hard. He saw what we were able to do and gave me a chance to run the offense at Ohio State, and kind of the rest is history.
You brought this up a moment ago, talked about being the only child of a single mother, and coaches were your dads. It almost sounds like I'm probably trying to force this. Hey, man, we have some similar background stuffs, but of course, I'm taken with the story of your dad. And it is not something that is dissimilar between the two of us either. I had a dad who dealt with addiction. I lost my dad early. All I can say is it was hugely formative in my life and continues to be to this day. It's probably in the background of almost every motivational choice that I make. I know your dad was in and out of your life, and you lost him fairly early. Do you feel the same way? Is it something that's always with you? Is it something that you think about? What can you share with me about that?
I loved my dad. Despite his shortcomings, always tried to help him. I never understood addiction. I do now. Everybody uses the word disease, and it is, but it's a disease that affects different people in different ways. And as a young child, teenager, young man, I could never understand why, my dad could go into treatment and stay sober for a year, and us have a really good relationship, and then him relapse, and things would go south again. And then you look at other men and women that have been sober for 30, 40, 50 years, and you say, well, if they can do it, why can't you? And so you harbor a little bit of resentment. You want to say, well, you're not trying hard enough. You're not committed enough. So I understand it much more now at this age, but I didn't when I was young, but it does motivate me, because I don't want to say my dad was a bad dad. He wasn't when he was sober. We had some really good times together, but when you die in a homeless shelter when you're 52 years old, that's not the life that anybody envisions. I don't ever want to put my children, my family, the people that I love and who love me through what I had to go through.
I really appreciate you sharing that. I'll tell you from this perspective, I don't talk about my situation much at all. I will if I'm asked.
Yeah, I didn't even know that about you. Will, what if you don't mind me asking, what are the specifics?
My dad struggled with alcohol, just like yours. I can't speak to the specifics. There's all kinds of different alcoholics. There are alcoholics that drink every day, and then there's alcoholics that binge drink. But the emotional impact to me was exactly as you described. It's a yo-yo. It's back and forth. It's resentment. It's responsibility. Why can't you get this together? It's guilt for feeling resentment, And ultimately, it's understanding powerlessness. I had no ability to fix this, even though as a young person, I'm talking preteen and teen, thinking it was on me to fix it. No ability to fix it whatsoever. And ultimately, my dad died, and this is the part you asked, so I'll tell you, but I never really talk about it. In his 50s, just like your dad, my dad took his own life. And the weird thing, Tom, is, like you just said, it's not only was he not a bad dad, in my situation, he was a great dad. And despite all of that, I think the thing that motivates me more than anything, more than money, more than anything, is this intangible sense of wanting to make him proud.
Yeah, it's really weird because of the yo-yo relationship that I had with my dad. I do know, me being his only child, he was very proud of me, and you're right. There is a sense, you know, he got to see me get married, but he's never met any of his grandchildren. You know, I do hope that, you know, he's looking down from above and is proud of, you know, the dad and husband and person that I've become. And, but it certainly brought, me and my mom closer together too, you know, and making her proud is extremely important to me too. And, but most importantly, my wife and three kids, you know, I want to be the best version of me, that I can be. And, you know, having, seen someone, failures, not the right word, but struggle, to be, my dad was a college graduate, you know, and wound up homeless the last couple of years of his life. And, you know, so it just, you're right. There's an intrinsic motivation that A, you want to make him proud, but B, you don't want your family to go through what you went through either.
Exactly. You probably expected more of a conversation on whether or not Jordan Whittington was going to play wide receiver or running back, but I really appreciate you.
I appreciate your path. Anybody, you know, I remember meeting you for the first time. I think it was a few years ago at one of the ESPN car washes, which seems like such a foreign concept in today's environment. But to watch you rise from basically legal analyst, if I'm not mistaken, a guy that went to law school, to now having your own show and being an expert in a lot of fields other than sport. I do listen to your show regularly and think you do a fantastic job. And this is not meant for this conversation is not meant for you and I to just compliment each other for an hour, but I do have a lot of respect for you because of your breadth of background and knowledge, and it's kind of cool to see a guy go to law school and think you're going to be a practicing attorney and then say, you know what, this isn't my passion, and I'm going to go live my passion and start off on whatever it was you started off on, First Take or whatever it was that we met, and to see where you're at now, and the sky's the limit for you.
I appreciate that very much. I mean, the feeling of respect is mutual. I think you know that. And I know that all of my friends, most of which are Texas fans, and almost my entire social circle is still between the Red River and the Rio Grande, are rooting for you. And you're right. This shouldn't just be an hour of us complimenting each other. So let me challenge you. You listen to the Will Cain Show. You know I would anyway. So with that being said, me being a fan rooting for you and having the respect that I definitely do for you, let me challenge you on a few things. So we're talking today. It's Friday, the day after the first round of the NFL draft. I believe from 99 to 15 was a stretch where there was a Texas player taken in the first round of the draft every single year. And now Texas is on a stretch where it's five straight years, or four, since 2015, that no Texas player has been taken in the first round of the draft. I saw an analysis that said it's put the fourth most NFL players into the league out of the Big 12 behind TCU, West Virginia, and Oklahoma. What's going on that Texas players right now aren't making their way to the NFL at the level I think everybody expects?
Well, I think one, you know, anytime there's instability for multiple years, that sets a program back quite a bit. You know, we had four different ADs in I think a 5-year span, two presidents, and three football coaches. And anytime you lack stability, you know, when you take over, you've got to generate that stability back. And, you know, when we took this over, it was quite literally the worst 3-year stretch in terms of 3 straight losing seasons in the 120 years that Texas has been playing football. And there's been a lot of mistakes were made in recruiting, you know, to see that. Trust me, nobody was more upset that, you know, of the 32 players taken in the NFL draft last night, 7 of them played high school football in the state of Texas, and none of them played at the University of Texas. And, you know, those recruits and those things happened before we got here. You know, we're proud of the guys that will get drafted hopefully today and some tomorrow. And the development that we've been able to provide them in a short period of time, but it starts with recruiting. And, you know, you've got to be spot on your evaluations. You know, and then you got to develop them. And I kind of went on a text rant with my staff last night about, you know, recruiting and evaluation and not worrying about stars and this, that, and the other, and then development. And, you know, we feel like in the coming years, you're going to see guys like Sam Cosmi be a potential first round pick. You know, we feel like Sam Ellinger, you know, will be a high draft pick. We feel like, you know, our first full recruiting class of 18 that, you know, was a top 5 class in the country. You know, if these guys stick around and listen to sound advice, that you're going to have guys like Caden Stearns and Jalen Green and Deshaun Jameson and Joseph Osai, you know, all of those guys in the conversation for being first rounders. So we feel like we're headed in the right direction. It's a shame that it had gotten to this point to when we took over, but we're here for a reason. And the reason was because, you know, this program had underperformed significantly compared to the standards that had been set here for generations. And it's our job to fix it. But, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens with a really, really thorough and relentless recruiting evaluations and, you know, keeping some of the best kids in state. I feel like I'm partly to blame when I'll never forget when I first got hired by Coach Meyer. We were on a plane and, you know, I asked him, I said, you know, what are our active recruiting areas going to be? And he said, you know, obviously Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, the Midwest, Florida, and Georgia. And I said, Coach, what about Texas? And he said, well, I've never really actively recruited Texas. I said, Coach, give me 1 year and let me recruit Texas, because that's where all my ties were. And, you know, the next thing, you know, we're signing JT Barrett and, you know, Dontre Wilson, who we beat the University of Texas on, and, you know, guys like Mike Mitchell and Demetrius Knox, who wound up being a starter. So, you know, I knew from having coached in this state my whole life, pretty much my whole coaching career, that the talent that was here. And, you know, now we've got to do a really good job of one, keeping the best players in the state of Texas home. And we feel like we've done a really good job of that, especially with that 2018 class. I think we signed 8 of the top 10 players in the state of Texas. And then this year we've got a couple of the top 10 kids in the state of Texas committed. So it starts with recruiting and keeping the best players at home, and then you got to develop them and put them in great positions to succeed.
Yeah, you got to cut off that recruiting trail that you created up to Columbus, because we're watching guys like Jeff Okuda go third overall last night, and he should have been a Horn, I imagine. But wait, I want to come back to development, and I want to do it, if we can, it's actually recruiting and development. I want to do it through one position group, because I do find this fascinating, and I was reading about this. I'm looking at all the quarterbacks you've had, not just at Texas. Guys like Greg Ward, Cardale Jones, as you mentioned, JT Barrett, now Sam Ehlinger, and even your quarterback room right now with Hudson Card and Jaquindon Jackson coming in, Casey Thompson already there. They're all so different, Tom. They're different in body size, type, even playing style, I think, to some extent, which brings us back to something else. Intangible, right? I guess there's some commonality you're looking for that you've seen from program to program, from quarterback to quarterback. What is it in that position in particular that you find as a consistency that you need?
I think especially at that position, you start with the intangibles. Competitiveness is number one on our list. I want a guy that, you know, wants to skunk his grandma in tiddlywinks, you know, and wants to win at everything he does, not just in sport, but in life and in academics. You want a guy that's a natural leader, one that players gravitate towards. You want an unbelievable work ethic, a passion to get better. And then the style of play will figure itself out. We'll build offenses around the best quarterback. You know, the offense, even in the span of 1 year at Ohio State, you know, when Braxton Miller was going to be the starter and got hurt in training camp and then were forced to, play JT Barrett as a redshirt freshman, and the style and kind of the things that we majored in were much different than with Braxton. And then when Cardale was thrown into the fire for the playoffs, we changed quite a bit and leaned on Zeke and the run game quite a bit, and Cardale's ability to throw the ball down the field. You know, and Greg Ward, we tailored the offense around him and his skill set, and then even, you know, when Sam leaves, I'm sure the offense will look a little bit different. So I think it's all about adaptability in terms of playing to your guys' strengths. But when you're out on the recruiting trail, you definitely gotta do your homework on the intangibles, because we've all seen guys with talent that never materialize because those intangible things are lacking.
I know you've got an appointment in about 10 minutes. I got about three things I'd love to hit with you before I lose you.
I've got another 20 minutes. This is fun, man. Whatever you're comfortable with, I'm here for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Tom. Buddy of mine at ESPN, a guy who's really earned my respect, even though I think he's wrong on a lot of things, is Dan Orlovsky, who played in the NFL. Being right isn't what gathers my respect. It's your critical ability to think, even if you come to the wrong conclusion. But Dan manages to come to the wrong conclusion often, but he's a smart guy. But he told me he once asked Dan Mullen, Dan Mullen told him, one of his favorite ways to judge a quarterback that was already in the program was to put your ones with your threes. So take your starting quarterback, take all the talent away from him, make him play with your third string players, and see who wins, see how they play. He said in that environment, you see leadership, you see guys who can bring others up and make them play above their heads. You see exactly what you need. And then Orlovsky asked Mullen, well, in all your years, who did that the best? And Mullen's answer was it was Dak Prescott at Mississippi State. A, do you believe in something like that? Do you think that is a good way to analyze quarterbacks? And B, who would be your answer in all your years so far? Who would pass that test?
Yeah, I do. And we've done that from time to time, maybe not as much as Coach Mullen does. But I do think that's a good barometer. Who would be the best? Wow. I've coached some good ones, Will. It would have to be Sam or JT, one of the two. I mean, they're the, you know, I've been around some really, really good leaders, but there's kind of this tier above the great ones that I've coached, and those two are on that Mount Rushmore, as well as our starting middle linebacker at University of Houston, a young man by the name of Landon Roberts, who wound up starting for the Patriots as a seventh round pick as a rookie when they won the Super Bowl in Houston. Those guys just have a way of making everybody around them better. And if it's not, you know, ripping somebody's butt, you know, when they make a mistake, it's almost more so the confidence that some of these younger guys, these twos and threes that are playing with and in front of that guy, that they just know, hey, that this guy's going to lead us down the field to score. And you know, I would say that certainly Sam and JT were probably the two that come to mind that were the best at having that ability.
I got to say, from a distance, it certainly appears that Sam is that guy. It certainly appears that he has all those leadership traits that you describe. I want to go back to development, if we can. You did something pretty big this year. You let go of both your offensive and defensive coordinators. Now, that's a big move. I know it's one I've read you went and talked to Notre Dame head coach Brian Kelly about integrating new coordinators into your system. I think when you make a change like this, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, you know I'm always open to that, but when you make a change like this, to some extent, and I don't think it is 100%, but to some extent, it's an admission of a prior error, that something wasn't working. So what I'm curious about is, if you saw something that wasn't working or might have been an error with Todd Orlando or Tim Beck or yourself, what gives you confidence that the choices you've made this time with Ash and Urich, that you got it right?
Well, one, I've worked with Coach Ash now on three separate occasions. I've actually coached against him when, you know, he was the defensive coordinator at Wisconsin, and I was the offensive coordinator at Ohio State, and you know, we wound up winning the game in double overtime at Camp Randall. But it was, you know, we had Braxton Miller, Carlos Hyde. You know, we had some weapons, and it was a really difficult night moving the football. And in talking to him after, when we were then together at Ohio State, you know, we started talking about that night, and the one thing that stood out was just his attention to detail and his ability to prepare his team in a week, you know, to play against us. And he had, on first and second down, he literally had one call, and he called it Buckeye check. And he told me this, obviously, after the fact. And he was able to teach his players within a week of installing a game plan based on different formations, based on different backfield alignments, based on different wide receiver splits, based on different tight end alignments. What was the coverage check? What was the front check going to be? And he just called Buckeye check. And his kids ran the show, and they did it marvelously. And that spoke volumes to me on the level of simplicity that he can, you know, break the game down, make it simple for his players. And then when I interviewed him for this job, the one thing that certainly stood out was, you know, he said, we've got to be simple yet not predictable. And that is what we were lacking. We were not simple. I felt like we put too much on our young guys' plate on that side of the football, and they weren't able to handle it and execute it to the best of their talent level. And so I wanted to simplify, certainly, on that side of the ball, and get lined up right, be in the right place, the right time, at the right time, know your assignment, be great tacklers, be very physical. And that, you know, certainly, you know, leads to really good defense. And then offensively, you know, I had admired Mike Yurcich from afar for quite some time, having been in the same conference as him. And just his ability to take the talent level that he had. Now granted, you know, he did have some very talented players, and Whedon and Blackman and some of the guys that he was able to coach at Oklahoma State. You know, I felt like I had become, as the primary play caller, a jack of all trades and a master of none. And, you know, that I was robbing Peter to pay Paul. I had let things slip defensively as the head, because the buck stops with me, right? And, you know, things had slipped defensively, but yet I was consumed with the offense and then everything that comes extracurricularly, if you will, of being the head coach at Texas, that I needed a guy that I could trust would bring fresh ideas, but that was still aligned with what I believe an offense should look like, bring some fresh ideas, but also be able to manage the room and the game plan and certainly call plays on game day to allow me to be a better head coach, the head coach that I know I can and have been. And, you know, I go back to the 2 years I had with Major Applewhite at the University of Houston, and that was a match made in heaven. You know, I was certainly involved in the offense and was in the game planning meetings, and you know, nothing happened on that side of the ball. Nothing happens on either side of the ball without my stamp of approval. But you know, when I've got to leave to go to a press conference or go to a lunch with a donor or whatever, that I know that, you know, things are being handled and that our sides of the ball are going to be prepared come Saturday. Mm-hmm.
You brought up, I want to go back to your timeline really quickly, your coaching career. You brought up your time with Major at Houston. Obviously, you were with Urban in Ohio State. If I asked you, and I am going to ask you, what's the best year of your career right now? What year would you point to? That's when I was hitting on all cylinders. That was a great year.
There's not one. I would say, you know, overachieving in 2018 here and winning 10 games, winning the Red River Showdown, and you know, beating a top five team in a New Year's Six bowl game. You know, that was certainly one just because it came as the head coach of my dream job. Now we've got bigger fish to fry. You know, we want to win a conference championship and a national championship, but to know in just our second year of a massive rebuild, we were able to do, and accomplish those things. I think going 13-1, my first year as a head coach and, you know, beating Florida State, in the Peach Bowl the way that we did and, you know, dominating, you know, the way that we did, that year and winning the conference and finishing in the top 10 for a group of five school. And then, you know, you can never take away the, euphoria of winning a national championship. That 2014 team, it's different when you're a coordinator as opposed to a head coach, but, knowing that we did it with, you know, three different quarterbacks and we made the run through the conference championship game in the playoffs with our third string quarterback. And that was my position. Those were, probably the three most gratifying seasons, to date.
And then on the other side, we talked about some of our personal trials, but, I'm a big believer. I don't know if you are. I'm a huge believer that failure is 10 times the teacher success is. So what's the biggest failure professionally so far?
Oof. Probably, you know, having a few slip-ups our second year at Houston. You know, we had a good enough team to where we beat Heisman Trophy winner Baker Mayfield. We beat Heisman Trophy winner Lamar Jackson. But yet we lost a couple games that we shouldn't have. You know, still finished 9-3 and ranked. You know, we missed out on a few opportunities that season. And underachieving last year, you know, you can point to a lot of different reasons for that. You know, we're never going to use injury or youth as an excuse ever. We didn't have the young guys that had to step into key roles early in the season. We just didn't have them prepared well enough to, have the regular season that we wanted to. Now, when we were healthy, as you saw against Utah, a top 10 team in a major bowl game, you know, and what we were able to do in that game. And, you know, obviously we played LSU closer than anybody did last year, and we certainly take no joy in moral victories, but I think you know, just not having some of those young guys prepared to step in and play at the level that we needed to win more games last season.
And what's the lesson from those failures?
That we got to develop better. That we've got to pay attention to our twos and our threes more, and their development, and that we got to continue to recruit because you got to have depth. There's going to be injuries. There's going to be years when, you know, three safety, you know, a safety breaks his arm, you know, I mean, what do you, I don't know any exercise, to do to prevent a broken arm. You know, it's not for lack of weight room or anything like that, but you know, we had some freak injuries and didn't have those guys prepared. And then, the lesson was, and hopefully I've rectified it, that, you know, I need, to delegate more of the offense to some really competent, you know, not just competent, but you know, the best at their craft, and you know, acquiesce a little bit of that, and get more involved in the I guess the 30,000 foot view of the team.
Well, anybody that's listened this long, and they will, they probably won't forgive me if I don't follow up on what was just a joke. But so, is Jordan Whittington a running back or a slot wide receiver? Or where are you going to put him on the field, Tom?
He's everything. He's a dynamic athlete. Obviously, last year because of the depth and injuries, we had him training at tailback, and I've never seen a kid. Well, we had two of them. Shoot, Roshan Johnson, having never played that position before in his life, two weeks before the first game, we tell him to go play running back, and he rushes for 600 yards and catches 20 balls and scores, you know, 6-8 touchdowns, whatever it was. But the question about Jay Witt, this season he will train with the receivers as a slot receiver, but you'll certainly see him in the backfield quite a bit as well.
Well, I could talk to you for another 2 hours about Tavondre Sweat and Demarion Overshown and Bijan Robinson and everybody that I love keeping up with what you're doing. But I was really more interested in talking about you because what we care about, I think, as fans, and I think as a fan of you, I care about the culture and the man behind it and the leadership. And I'm grateful you shared so much with me and you gave me so much time. I really mean this. I mean, I wish you all the luck in the world. I'm pulling for you. And I'd love to continue talking to you whenever you're available.
Thanks, Will. You've got a great show. I respect the heck out of you. I truly appreciate you having me, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask, is you and your family, I know you're on the East Coast there, everybody safe and healthy and doing okay?
They are. We decamped to Tennessee. It's weird. Here, everybody says UT, and they're talking about the wrong school. But my brother-in-law has a place in Tennessee that allowed us to get out of New York City. It's my brother-in-law whose son I texted you about the other day. You might want to keep your eye on. But we're good. We're safe. I appreciate the advice, by the way, very much. And I hope you and your family are doing well. Austin's a good place to be, and I hope you guys are safe and healthy.
We are. And, again, I appreciate the time, man, and hook 'em horns.
Yeah, hook 'em, Tom. Thank you.